Hey folks, I'm David Goldstein.
I'm Brian Brinkman.
And I'm Tom Marshall.
And we are back with part two of our Beyond the Pond interview with Tom Marshall. As you know, this is the Beyond the Pond podcast, the podcast which Brian, myself, and this time Tom, use fish as a means of getting the listener to go beyond the pond and listen to some Nam Jam bands. So, you know what we do, you know what the intro is, now we're just going to jump back in.
I think we wanted to kind of pick up, Tom, kind of how did we get here? How did we get to where we are right now from a musical, from a lyrical standpoint? And you and I had been talking kind of before we went to record about kind of your timeline, your from Genesis to Revelation timeline.
Yes.
Tell us just a little bit about kind of your origins as a listener, records that you really connected with, and kind of like that pathway for you kind of through adolescence.
Sure. I can plunge in deep and probably go into like solo narrative mode, and it might not be an interview anymore, but I mean, feel free.
By all means. Because I was thinking about this and thinking
there's no quick way to say it, but maybe we can intersperse it when I mention a song or an album or something with actual music. But the way I was thinking about this was it's defined in a way, my musical background is defined by my schooling, and really when I went to Princeton Day School is when it was firmly defined, and that was in eighth grade.
Okay.
Prior to that, I think I had said before, I was like a Beatles guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, Trey and I later in life, when we were writing, it was the Cook Cabin writing session, and I want to think what song might have gotten to Fish from there. Maybe Let Me Lie.
Okay.
Yeah, that one was one. There was a couple others. But in any case, around the table some friends had shown up, and all of a sudden someone mentioned something about a Broadway show, and I said, well, my only Broadway show that I know from start to finish by heart is Jesus Christ Superstar, because my parents had that album, Let It Be, and Abbey Road. Oh, and Bridge Over Troubled Water. And it turns out Trey knows every single word and song from Jesus Christ Superstar as well. Uh-huh. So that also, I have to say, has some part of my formation.
That's the inception, right?
Sorry, possibly.
But we watched that back in junior high school in our music class.
Yeah.
Which in retrospect seems kind of odd, given some of the lyrics or the overtones of the lyrics.
Yeah.
But it's so great.
And it's also like the Roman soldiers had Nazi helmets and machine guns, and that is some crazy stuff. Maybe imagery that nowadays wouldn't pass muster, you know, with the PTA club.
Right, no. Just remember the whole thing with King Herod, and so you are the Christ, the great Jesus Christ. I think that was Lin-Manuel Miranda's inspiration for in Hamilton when he did like King George.
Oh, so you are the Christ, you're the great Jesus Christ. prove to me that you're no fool.
Walk across my swimming pool.
If you do that for me, well, I'll let you go free.
Exactly.
Come on, King of the Jews.
You are the Christ, you're the great Jesus Christ. To me that you're divine, change my water into wine, that's all you need to, then I'll know it's all true. Come on, King of the Jews. Ooh. Jesus, you just won't believe.
So anyway, Trey and I sang every song for these two friends that were there that night. And I should say, hey, Trey, you were breaking a rule by having friends over, because that's one of our writing rules, is no friends. But
no friends.
All right. We overlooked it then. So in eighth grade, I arrived at a very musical Princeton Day School grade, and all my friends were drummers. Trey was a drummer at the time. My friend Mark Daubert was a drummer. My friend Peter Catoni was a drummer. And so the two pillar bands that they kind of turned me onto that I totally went deep into were Yes and Genesis.
Okay.
And that put me immediately onto the progressive rock side of our grade, which was almost divided in half by the other half, which was like Springsteen and the band guys. And like, we almost had to pretend that we didn't like the other side's music. It was so elitist.
Just the Sharks.
It was really incredibly that much of a division between them. And Trey managed to stay out of the fray and skated above it because he liked both equally. And he eventually took me to Grateful Dead show. We saw Jerry a couple times together. but that was firmly on the other side. For me, it was progressive. It was art rock.
Okay.
And so, Yes, the drummer for the significant Yes albums that matter for me, that's the Yes album, which is their first album, I believe, and then Fragile and Close to the Edge, all had the drummer Bill Bruford.
Okay.
And he was tremendously important to me. He's amazing American, you know, in a band of Brits, this American technical drummer. And I was just so, you know, spurred on by my drummer friends, amazed by his abilities, and loved it for that reason. And then the other pillar for me, there's three pillars, but the other of the two big pillars of music was Genesis. And that drummer was Phil Collins.
Yeah.
So now Phil Collins is an amazing, amazing drummer. And people think of him as the kind of cheesy pop song dude.
Right.
Because that's how he made a ton of money and got really, really famous. But prior to that, in the only way I recognize him is as Genesis's drummer. And he was phenomenal in that regard. Then I have one more pillar, and it's Brian Eno, because I had friends that turned me on to Brian Eno early, who's a eclectic British songwriter, but also more famous as a producer.
Right.
Produced Talking Heads, produced U2, mm-hmm. produced Dave Matthews, yeah. I think.
Produced the best Coldplay album.
Coldplay.
Yeah. The best album, the Brian Eno record.
And then Brian Eno appeared on as a producer, although it's just credited on one song, of my favorite album of Genesis, which is The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway.
Right.
Brian Eno's name is in there. So, like, there's... it was beginning to form this, like, group of largely British people that I started really realizing were the core of my music existence.
Do you have, kind of looking in hindsight, do you have any idea why that's what you were drawn to and not the Springsteen, the band, American roots rock?
I think I was, at the time, I was an incredible fan of the music of, like, the thickness of the music.
Okay.
And these incredible players putting together such an amazing masterpiece. And then the lyrics, like, were the bonus that sailed on top of this incredible composition. And I was really into the complexity of it. Whereas, you know, I wasn't getting that so much from the band and Springsteen.
Totally.
You know, it took me until later in life to realize, like, the intense beauty. Although I had, because of being Beatles, I had that simplicity.
You had the storytelling background.
Yeah.
But with the Beatles,
I needed
you
something
have this
else.
Very, like, mathematical, formulaic approach to building songs.
I think so. And I think I was just, like, I was overwhelmed and just incredibly gratified to find bands that were bottomless wells of discovery. So you could listen to a Yes song.
We don't know anything about
that.
You could listen to a Yes song over and over again, the same one. And by that, I mean the studio version. Because, like, you guys listen to the same Fish song,
yeah.
but different live versions.
Absolutely.
This was just, like, listening to the one album over and over again and finding new stuff in it.
Right.
But so if we had to play... Oh, and the incredibly important thing to say about the Yes album, Close to the Edge, is that's one of the first ones that Trey and I bonded over as friends.
That's, like,
that album
for you guys.
Yep, pretty young, at his father's house. I recall an evening we were writing crazy songs, and we took a break, and he put on the song Close to the Edge. And we all just sort of sat back in the couch until all of a sudden he jumped up and pulled the needle off the record And he goes, we can do that. We can do better than that. And I remember just the audacity. I looked at my friend Mark Dauber and I was like, yeah, sure. Okay. Rolled eyes, you know, at Trey. And, well, I think he's done it. I think he proved that he could do better than that.
I mean, what would Fish be without Trey's ambition from
that
inception?
Yeah.
That early point in the career. That's, oh, wow. That's wild.
You talk about Yes, was Fish obviously changing their set list every night. Yes did a thing a year ago, which I thought was crazy, in that I think they released about 9 or 10 shows from a fall 1972 tour.
Oh my
So it was like what the Dead was doing in Europe 72. They released these 10 shows, and I think each of them has the exact same set list, and they're all on Spotify, and you can go through them and see they're separated by seconds, like roundabout. The difference between one roundabout and the other is like only like 2 seconds. They were so precise. I'm thinking, why did they release 10 of these which sound... I've listened to all of them.
Identical. All,
I can't tell the difference, but I guess somebody can.
That's funny. That's interesting because...
It's the ultimate set list.
They did not stretch. You know, they didn't have jam sections that much. I mean, maybe in a song called Starship Trooper... Steve Howe maybe didn't play the exact same lead every time.
Right.
But for the most part, these things were written down consciously,
right.
Crafted by, you know, consummate music students, you could tell. This other drummer, Alan White, then took over for Bill Bruford in Yes. And he was also, I think he was a British guy. And later, Alan White went on and played with John Lennon.
Oh, wow.
So that kind of ties this to the Beatles,
wow.
Which is kind of cool. But Alan White then became the de facto Yes drummer for a long, long time. So when people think of Yes drummer, they don't think of Bill Bruford, sadly, to me, because Fragile and Close to the Edge are their quintessential albums and their best lineup, which had also Chris Squire on keyboards.
Yeah.
On bass, and Rick Wakeman on keyboard. Sorry, because the Yes album had Tony Kaye on keys. Anyway, so that's a little bit. If you were going to play songs
let's play
from some. There, I would definitely play... I mean, it's their most famous and possibly at the time their most accessible song, but Roundabout is a song that never stops giving.
Oh,
and
it's amazing. I saw a marching band from Ramsey, New Jersey once play Roundabout, and it was still great.
And I just recently heard it on a car ride from Maryland, and I was tired, and I needed an ear break, and it came on, and instead of an ear break, my friend turned it up. And I was about to say, turn this shit off. I'd heard this song way too many times. And then I realized, oh, my God. I hadn't heard Roundabout in about a year or more, and it was just unbelievably good. It
put me on the road with the levels up.
On the road with the levels up, and you hear how thick and masterful it is.
Right.
So that would be, if you had to play a Yes song, I'd play that. But also the song that Trey, in the middle of, you know, picked the album up, and that's, I would at least play the intro, the first 2 minutes, if you could, of Close to the Edge.
Okay.
Because that's just stunning music.
Yeah.
Fish, yeah. And that's Bill Bruford back there on the drums, and he does incredible stuff. It sounds like he's hitting garbage can lids together or something. It's just gorgeous. Yeah. Maybe play that one too.
Yeah. I can do that again.
The Fish. Yeah. Okay, cool. So that's pillar one was Yes. Pillar two was Genesis. And it rapidly, for me, became the way that I wanted to write music.
Okay.
Was, I think I mentioned before, but just to be clear, Peter Gabriel was one of the founding members of Genesis and was the chief songwriter and singer of Genesis. And that, to me, is the only real Genesis. After that, it became the Phil Collins Project.
Okay.
Right. After he left. And then when Peter Gabriel left, he then made three amazing solo albums, the third of which they call Melt because his face is melting, but they were all just called Peter Gabriel.
Okay.
But the one called Melt was produced by this guy named Steve Lillywhite.
Yes.
Steve Lillywhite then went on to produce two Fish albums. He produced Billy Breathes and Joy.
Yes.
And the reason he's notable is because he's also a British guy who did a lot of stuff with Robert Fripp, Brian Eno, and possibly even David Bowie.
Yeah.
So these pillars in my high school were forming, and we become evident later. Trey was, of course, absorbing and listening to all this stuff, too. And you can totally hear it in some of the music. If you listen to some of this stuff, you hear it. But Peter Gabriel became my idol, my songwriting idol, by far. And the last album that Genesis wrote with Peter Gabriel was The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway.
Yeah.
And that is an absolute masterpiece. It's a double album masterpiece that you have to hear. And on that song is a track that was Trey's and my favorite called Carpet Crawlers.
Okay.
And you should probably play that if you can.
Let's throw that on.
And that one has, you know, lyrics. I mean, that to me is a combination of music and lyrics and imagery and everything. It just has it all. It's through the door, the harvest feast is lit by candlelight. It's the bottom of a staircase that spirals out of sight. It's like some of the most beautiful thoughts and images are in there. And they don't necessarily add to the story. And that's kind of what I liked about it. I was like, I can take what I want from that and apply it to the story.
The fleas cling to the golden fleece, hoping they'll find peace. Each thought and gesture, a card and serenade. There's no hiding the memory, there's no wrong to avoid. The crawlers cover the floor.
Brian Eno, his solo work is just incredible. He was tied in with these musicians in many ways, as we mentioned before. But his solo stuff is just so beautiful and kind of simplistic.
Yeah.
And yet he was an amazing recording pioneer and mastered stuff using two tape decks before there were real long echoes. So he would actually have two tape decks, and he would turn the erase head off but keep the record head on, and then have actually a long loop. It would go across the room from one deck to the other, and the distance and the length of the tape would be the length of the echo. So he would have his friend Robert Fripp, an incredible guitarist, playing into that. And it would echo, you know, maybe sometimes 5 seconds later after he played. And they would make it, you know, they would cut the tape until it matched the rhythm of the song that they were playing. I actually had to go in with scissors and tape. And, you know, so there's that kind of effect on Brian Eno's early albums. And it was that that made all these other bands want him as a producer, including U2.
I feel like if you really, from a production standpoint, and I guess just in rock music, I don't know if there's a more influential producer, and kind of the origins of the sounds that you hear from the mid-1970s to today in rock music all can be found in Brian Eno. I'm curious for you, you know, lyrically, he had such a unique approach.
Yes.
The oblique strategies, I want to say, those cards that he would put out, and they would just have a concept on it.
Yes.
And he would start to write off of that.
And that's how, right, that, so you could buy a card deck that you just sort of pull out and try to write a song about, I guess, is what
they were like an idea or a command.
Some bizarre thing that came out of his head, yeah.
Did that ever in any way, like...
No, but my friend Stefan Scherber, hey Stefan, had that deck that we looked at, and it kind of freaked us out that Brian Eno did this. But at the time, I wasn't really using it as a compositional tool.
Yeah, okay.
I'd like to try it now.
Yeah, yeah, that'd be interesting.
Yeah. So that album, Another Green World, was the one also Trey and I bonded over. And Fish even played a song from it that you should play, the Eno version and maybe the Fish version.
Sure.
Because they change in tempo, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And that song is called I'll Come Running.
Yes.
And to complete that phrase, it's I'll Come Running to Tie Your Shoe. And it's very
one of the
funny.
Sweetest love songs I feel like I've ever heard.
Yes.
Like, what a basic concept of how you're going to care for someone throughout their life.
Yes.
I'll find a place somewhere in the corner. I'm going to waste the rest of my days just watching patiently from the window, just waiting to see things change someday. I'll come running to tie your shoe. I'll come running to tie your shoe. I'll come running to tie your shoe. I'll come running to tie your shoe.
So when we were sophomores at Princeton Day School, me and Trey, two albums came out that were pivotal. And one you guys can guess because Trey did it for Halloween, and that's Remain in Light by Talking Heads, also produced by Brian Eno.
Yes.
Talking Heads had a guitarist named Adrian Belew.
Yes.
Just put that in the back of your mind. The other album was the one I've mentioned before, 1980, Peter Gabriel, Melt. But the thing that when you go and see Peter Gabriel live, still to this day, is this bass player named Tony Levin. And Tony Levin would play a regular bass, like a Fender bass, but with little tiny rubber cups on the ends of his fingers that were attached to drumsticks. And so he would hammer, so he learned how to play that way, but then he would swap out that guitar for a thing I'd never seen in my life, called a Chapman stick. And that's probably about a 12-string instrument that extends lower than the bass range and higher than the guitar range. And you have to teach yourself how to play it because you can't just pick it up and play it. And you look unusual playing it unless you're Tony Levin.
Right.
And then he's probably the only guy that can look cool playing that thing. And he became an expert at it. And Tony Levin is like one of the most sought-after studio bass players, so much so that Michael Jackson used him in... I want to say maybe it was the song Black and White.
Okay.
Like, so much that when I heard it, I was like, that's Tony Levin. He's playing the stick.
Yeah.
That's him. I think it's Black and White or else bad. Anyway, it's one of those. The people that I just wanted to mention in that were Adrian Belew from the Talking Heads album that just came out, Tony Levin on bass. I had mentioned earlier Bill Bruford, being the drummer for Yes, and then Robert Fripp as the guitarist for Brian Eno occasionally. Trey, this was a pivotal moment in our friendship and our songwriting evolution. We went to a King Crimson concert in Princeton at Richardson Auditorium. Sitting down before the show, Trey looked at me and he said, "We have to play on this stage someday." And we did. 25 years later, I sang Strange Design with Trey on that stage. At the time, it was called Alexander Hall. Now it's called Richardson Auditorium. It's a beautiful place. If you're ever near Princeton, at least walk by it. It's a circular, stunning building. And they don't lock it during the day, so you can walk in and look at it. It's a great place to catch some classical music if you're there for an extended stay. They always play. They have a large classical program that they want to play there, the Princeton Symphony. It's a wonderful, wonderful place. But that King Crimson lineup was Tony Levin on bass, Bill Bruford on drums, Adrian Belew on guitar, and then the famous Robert Fripp, who sits down playing guitar, sits on a stool, and plays in the corner. And depending on his on his mood, he'll pull that stool way back so he's like almost behind an amp, like if he's angry with the crowd.
Okay.
And otherwise, he'll come out a little further, and he'll admonish the crowd. He doesn't like photos being taken. Mm-hmm. He's just this consummate, tiny little British gentleman, but also a little bit irate. And he's this mechanical player. And the album that they were touring upon that blew me and Trey and our two friends Mark and Dave away was Discipline.
Okay.
And that first song they opened with was Discipline. And it takes discipline to play it. So you should play Discipline.
Let's do it.
Gets to the discussion of who's the actual front man. Like, when you think of AC/DC, the front man could be Angus Young, even though like Brian Johnson is like singing the vocals. Whereas the era of King Crimson, you almost think of Robert Fripp as the front man, having been in every King Crimson incarnation. It was Adrian Belew who's singing, playing the guitar, and being like the showman.
I think Fripp is happy to have someone else be the front man, so to speak, for every different incarnation.
Exactly.
That's kind of cool. So the most recent time I saw him, they played for the first time. I got to see a song from my favorite King Crimson album, which is called Lark's Tongues in Aspic. And they played the song Easy Money. And that's another one we should go out on, because that concludes what I wanted to...
That's Sam.
Yeah, I wanted to get that arc kind of described. Trey took me to many concerts, and as I said before, the Grateful Dead among them, and I started relaxing a little bit my progressive versus the other, you know, as I matured.
Yeah.
But that definitely influenced me to stay in the progressive side, and I'm glad I did, because it enabled me to dive really deep and learn about all these guys and all their tendrils that reach into other bands and stuff and really educate me musically.
I gotta ask you, so we've talked about Brian Eno, Robert Fripp a lot. They kind of form these pillars of a lot of what you've listened to, along with Peter Gabriel, Phil Collins, Genesis, but the song Brian and Robert, I believe, is about the two of them.
Right, so... yes, so that's Brian Eno and Robert Fripp.
Right.
But the words were written by me, just kind of about sort of like a, you know, a lonely dude kind of thing. And I sat down at a piano during a writing session with Trey and was kind of doing sort of simplistic chords. I think it was actually on a keyboard with an organ setting. And he kind of said, that sounds like a Brian Eno song. And what song is that? And I said, no, I'm kind of writing here. And he said, oh, cool. And put his guitar into Fripp mode with super feedback. It's like, whee! So much so that we decided we're going to name this song Brian and Robert before there are lyrics on it.
Oh, wow.
This is my memory of how it happened. And, of course, the way that I worked at the time, I would have a sheaf of lyrics. And I think it was one of those things where Trey kind of grabbed it, or I did, and just started singing after we had recorded the music part, the foundation.
So you have the foundation.
We had the music foundation. Now it's lyrics time, like we did Velvet Sea that way too, where Trey worked hard on getting this really cool sonic scape. Now it's time for the lyrics.
Okay.
So we wrote a few songs that way. Yeah.
Interesting.
So and it turns out Brian and Robert, people thought of as possibly a couple. Who knows? Maybe this person was missing his partner. I don't know, but it seemed to sort of fit well with the subject.
That was my nursery rhyme for my son in his first 9 months of life. That what put him to sleep every night.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Until he could understand what it was about.
Yeah, I mean, I always liked like the idea of like the lonely, like the isolation.
That's associated
with. That was the first Fish song I ever heard.
Oh wow!
On the intro to Bittersweet Motel, and I was like, "Who is this band?" I'd heard Fish.
Oh, fantastic!
But I had no idea what they sounded like.
Well, that's one of my favorite Fish songs. When they play that, I'm always incredibly excited. Because it's like Dirt. They play it rarely, and yet it's a ballad that I really enjoy.
It's a great little breath of fresh air, and that's a song I'd love to hear them at some point, just see what happens if they stretched it out a little bit.
It would be like Brian Eno.
You got like a sonic underpinning there for it.
Chases me a lot wherever I go. I've seen a bunch of them. It's always like when Trey spends like 3 minutes between the songs talking to Paige, then talking to Fish, and talking to Mike, going back.
And that comes out.
Yeah, that comes out. It's like, okay.
It's either that or Stash. They'll talk for like 5 minutes and you'll think like, oh, there's a huge rarity coming, and then Stash will come and everyone like claps along. But yeah.
I like when they're talking for a long time and they finally realize, oh, we've been talking for a long time, and then they start laughing.
Yeah.
And I think they're laughing because they still haven't figured out what song to play. Like, what are we going to actually do now? Is that just like Fishman telling them some anecdote, like what happened to him on the way to the show?
Or he like sees like something funny in the crowd.
Yeah.
I mean, one can only guess.
Yeah.
I've got a question. It seems like David Bowie's always had a really big presence in Fish's career. I mean, less of a direct influence, more of just a touchstone in terms of how to grow and function as artists. What did you take from Bowie, if anything, from a lyrical standpoint?
So... I had Hunky Dory and Ziggy Stardust as like a large part of my musical foundation. Both of those albums are still in my absolute favorites. But also Station to Station, I really liked. If you want to play, I think the Fish family knows Ziggy now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they know Hunky Dory because of Life on Mars. Probably people explored that. But Station to Station had a song that Trey and I listened to as we were driving once on the radio, and Trey was like climbing the walls. We couldn't figure out who it was until finally he sang, you know, because there's a long, cool jam in the beginning.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's got this really cool, really great. And Trey's like, who is this? Is this Zappa? Is this? I can't figure out. What? And he's all these guesses. And he's like angry because he knows it. And then Bowie starts singing. He's like, oh, it's Bowie.
Our last segment here, we kind of threw around this idea of the beauty of mistakes in music, and having Tom here to talk about his kind of songwriting experience and his collaborations with various musicians. You know, I think we all know, any of us who's ever tried to write songs, any of us who listens to songs, any of us who listens to Fish knows that oftentimes the best moments come from unintentional mistakes. I think immediately of the 11/22/94 Funky Bitch that apparently was going to end. Fishman hit the wrong drum note, or hit the wrong drum riff, and they went off on a 22-minute jam. That never would have happened without that. So we kind of talked about a couple of Fish songs that, you know, as we were preparing for this episode, Tom offered us some background in terms of the mistakes that really crafted them. And one of the songs that we wanted to talk about is a song that has, I think, really personal importance to you, obviously, to your friendship with Trey and to Fish where they are right now. That's Backwards Down the Number Line. And we kind of touched upon the themes of the Joy album earlier in our first episode, but I'm just curious, kind of what initially inspired you to write Backwards Down the Number Line?
People may have heard not different versions of this story, but may have heard this story before.
Yeah.
And I try not to tell it differently because it's how it happened. But basically, Trey was going through a kind of a court-mandated situation up in Saratoga Springs, New York. And at the time, this would be from 2006 to 2008, roughly. There was, you know, some overlap, I believe, on both of those years. He kind of went incommunicado. And I've been since corrected by either his father or stepmother about whether that was mandatory or not.
Okay.
To his program. But for whatever reason, I was not in touch with Trey for a long time. And ran into Ernie, his dad, at the mall, and said something. I'd love to reach out to Trey. I know he's got a birthday coming up. Love to say hi to him. I haven't said hi to him, and it's got to be more than 9 months or something along those lines. And I have some songs, you know, I'm thinking about, and I know he would, whether we can, you know, openly communicate or whatever or meet. I know he would love to have some of my lyrics and. So he could be writing, because I know he's writing wherever he is, yeah, or whatever he's doing.
Yeah.
And Ernie said, of course. And believe it or not, Trey's on email. And that was a first. Mm. That was a first. Trey didn't do email prior to that.
Interesting.
And I was overjoyed hearing that. And went home, got the, you know, realized how close I was to Trey's birthday, and wrote a birthday song to him.
Okay.
And that's what just spilled out. Was the lyrics to Backwards Down the Number Line.
So, I mean, a song like this doesn't sound to me like these are lyrics you labored over.
No, that one just, off the top of my head, I knew I was writing to my pal. I knew he was having a birthday.
Yeah.
And I clicked send. And that's when one of those wonderful things that used to happen back in the age of faxing and voice, answering machines, would be where I would, sometimes I would fax Trey lyrics or leave them on his answering machine, come back after work, and my answering machine would have an entire song, like, NICU or whatever on it. That's what happened. Trey, emailed me an answer almost immediately. It was just OMG, like, oh my God. And then, called me with the first version of Backwards Down the Number Line.
Wow.
Which didn't have that the bridge, but was everything else.
Okay. And so, I mean, the song
was solid,
itself,
and it's
right
beautiful
there.
And it's actually a version that I kind of like. I think should come out. It's even to me better, you know, just because of its originality.
Happy, happy.
So this was a song, it was written directly to Trey. Did you have any thoughts? I mean, I personally, when that song opened up Hampton Night 2, it sounded like this new, like they opened up this first set of Phish classics. It's like 14, 15 songs. And then they open up the second set with Backwards Down the Number Line, a song that to that point nobody had ever heard.
And it got pretty good recognition.
Great recognition. And that song to me feels like this, like, okay, now this is the next chapter.
I mean, and acceptance, not recognition, because no one recognized it.
Right, yeah, acceptance.
Great acceptance, yeah.
You know, to me, that song, I smile from ear to ear every time I hear it, because it's like, my thought always goes to, there is no fish without this song, you know, nowadays.
Yeah, it brought fish kind of out of the hiatus void.
Right.
And it's kind of nice when you think about it. It was music brought us out of that void.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like the oldest thing that Trey and I did was songwriting, and songwriting brought us out. Yep.
Did you ever think at the time, you're writing about one of your friends on a very personal level, but did you ever think that this is a song that's really about friendship in general?
I do. I mean, I like that it's been adopted as a birthday song.
Yeah.
for some people. Very much so. Yeah, it's a song people who have longtime friendships can relate to, because it talks about, you know, going back in time and thinking about when you were younger, and pondering, you know, the things that have happened in between then and now,
yeah.
That were relevant, and the ups and the downs that create a friendship.
Did it matter to you at the time if this led to a newfound writing partnership, or did you just, was it just a note?
I never doubted the partnership. I mean, we've gone through periods where there's been gaps in our songwriting and in our communication, and never that worried about that. However, this one was longer than the others. So I was expecting after this, and I was happy, very happy after this, that we would, you know, continue now on a more regular basis. And sure enough, that's happened.
Yeah. I saw only 3 shows in 2009, Fenway and Alpine Valley, and they didn't play it at any of those shows. And then I moved overseas for a year, and I came back and I saw a bunch of shows in summer 2010. And the first time I saw Backwards Down the Number Line, they played it for 14 and a half minutes, and it was at Blossom in Ohio, and they played this very dark jam off of it. And it was really surreal to hear this song that is so happy and about such renewal now being used as a way to kind of channel the dark side of fish, which, you know, from a jamming standpoint has always been where a lot of really interesting music comes from.
Right.
Do you have any particular memories of hearing it live for the first time, or of any particular versions that you like? That
first time was incredibly heartwarming. That one is one where we alluded to in part one of this podcast. That's one where I do feel sometimes eyes upon me, like, hey, how cute, this is the, you know, the friendship song kind of
right,
thing.
Right, right.
You know, that one I'm always also thinking of my friend Liz, who's in the audience, not liking the lyrical part, you know,
okay.
Which is hilarious. That doesn't bother me, by the way. I sort of.
Yeah.
We equally, you know, rib each other over the fact that she doesn't like Backwards Down the Number Line. That's fine. But
I think the genuine aspect of it, which might be what you're alluding to, is kind of the nature of friendship.
It's almost too emotional sometimes. You don't want it, like, these emotions have no place at a rock show.
Right.
And it's like two dudes being emotional. That's like hard for people to grasp too.
But it's funny. When I was at Double Chocolate Night at the Baker's Dozen, I sat behind the stage, actually. It was the only time I've ever sat behind a stage at a fish show. And they played Backwards Down the Number Line. And, you know, it was after significant jamming and some great song selection. And I remember looking at the whole crowd. And every time the lights would come on, when they would hit a peak, everybody had their hands in the air. Everybody had a smile on their face.
Nice.
And I said, this more than anything is why the band plays a song so often.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
you show them that you love this song too.
I think so. I mean, it's such a happy, cool jam. I love it. I love the chords. I love everything about it.
Yeah.
Such a great song.
Like Fish's Sugar Magnolia, which to me is interesting because for a band that's been around since 1983, to have the song come out in 2009, I mean, that much to the band and the fan base is really cool.
Nice.
And it's just, whether closing sets or opening sets or jamming, it's a big-hearted song that you'd have to be really, really curmudgeonly not to get some enjoyment out of.
Nice.
Which,
yeah, it makes me want to just hug a bunch of neighbors at a fish show.
That's perfect.
So from a lyrical standpoint, we had talked kind of before we went to recording that there was this big mistake in, or like unrealized aspect of Backwards on the Number Line.
Oh, yeah. So what I'm talking about is things that happen in the recording process.
Okay.
And Trey and I always contend, and like you know, we've mentioned before, we're not super religious, but possibly are spiritual. That the songs are sort of swirling around us. We can feel them. And if we can trick the muses to reveal the songs to us in some way, whether it's a mistake that we make or something, and suddenly there's the song in front of us materialized, we'll take it, right? Because it's hard to get the song out of the ether intact, you know, without injecting too much of yourself into it.
Totally.
You know, the contention being that the songs are out there, that we just have to realize them and
you're
put them
the
down.
You're just the conduits for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, like yeah. Sort of that's the thought. Some songs I definitely believe that for. Some songs are all directly I've written with no muse help at all. But in this case, the mistakes I'm talking about are Trey and I use a multi-track recording system where we'll put down track after track. Some will be bass, guitar, vocals, and sometimes by the time we're done tracking tracks 1 through 5, by the time we're about to do 6, and it wasn't what we had intended back when we recorded track 1. And sometimes it's enough, like, we've already moved on mentally away from the song that we'll actually even walk away from it. So there's lots of unrealized songs out there that never became songs. So in the case of for the song Secret Smile, I'm sorry, I'm going to go back to Backwards Down the
Number
Line.
Yeah, totally.
But so for this song Secret Smile, Trey and I had recorded, done a lot of work in the morning on a song we didn't know yet was going to be Secret Smile. And we knew that it kind of had a almost church-like reverence to it. And so he and I said, you know what would be really cool here is a choir, if an entire choir could be singing in the background of the song. And we'll figure out what lyrics go on it later. But let's do some sort of a choir. And Trey and I, because we're only two people, we figured we'll do 2 tracks of each of us singing. So that would be 4 people, each on a different note. And we started, for no reason, just singing, hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on. And then, like I said, we went and had a lunch and then weren't in the right mood to get back to it.
Okay.
We wrote other songs. Trey, the next day, thank goodness, pressed play on it and was like, I love it, and started singing the Secret Smile lyrics to it.
Wow.
Not knowing that right at the part where the hold on came that Trey and I sang the night before was right in the chorus that he had created for Secret Smile. And it worked so perfectly that he was almost brought to tears. And when I heard it, I was almost brought to tears, like, what the hell? And it was something that we wouldn't have been able to figure out if that wasn't, like, handed to us by the universe.
Totally.
You know?
Sometimes when the evening's young, dies down the setting sun, crochets the clouds with yarn so fine, and fills the oceans with red wine. The trees, the sky, the forest fair, give a flavor to the air. I raise my glass and in a while you answer with a secret smile.
So that's a mistake. The other mistake that you were referring to that I had kind of hinted to you earlier about Backwards Down the Number Line that was fortuitous was Trey, in practicing it, during kind of the chorus part, he started singing from the lyrics. He was going, oh, my friend, backwards down the number line, oh, my friend, backwards down the number line. He recorded that onto his iPhone.
Okay.
And then as he played it back, he realized that he liked it better, and he started singing it and hearing it as, all my friends come backwards down the number line. And it totally makes sense to the lyrics. It's like, when you think about it, you're talking about this incredible friendship,
yeah,
and now you bring in all my friends and how they all also are, you know, are represented on this number line of years.
Right.
And so it works for me. It's massive.
And it's all of
it. And it makes me as a lyricist look to or feel like a genius, like I came up with that, but really that was a mistake. You know? or a Trey, incredible Trey feat of songwriting.
Right.
Let's give it to that. And then I have one more that I forgot. Oh. So that's Secret Smile and All My Friends. I have one more idea about a mistake that happened in the recording process and was just incredible. And I can even play you the version. And it's a song that you guys both happen to love. It's Ghost.
Oh, man. Oh, man.
And so the way that was written was me on drums. And before we had pressed record, I was just sitting there kind of doing the only beat I know how. But for whatever reason, it sounded great on the kit that we had in the little barn where we were recording. And
Can I jump in?
Yeah.
Do you remember when you recorded it, because they debuted it in summer 97, did you record it that spring? Do you know?
This version that we can play, the original version of Ghost, came out on Trampled by Lambs and Pecked by the Dove.
Yeah.
Which is a, Beth put it together from three recording sessions in Stowe, Vermont.
Okay.
In farmhouses.
Okay.
Where we recorded between, I believe, 95 and 96.
Oh wow! So it goes
or 90, back. Yeah, 95 and 96.
So it goes that far.
I think so. Oh, I think so. Yeah, read her liner notes to be sure that it's not 96, 97, but I think it's 95, 96.
Did you, before you go on with this story, did you get a sense when you were writing this song, like it's a song that really seems to have changed Phish? There's really no precedent for a song like Ghost before Ghost. It's so Talking Heads, it's so like everything that you were talking about in terms of your own musical evolution, it goes back to it's incredibly funky, incredibly dark, and that's the sound that the band overtook for like 96 97 98 99 2000. Was there any sense when you're writing this, like looking ahead, that this is a directional shift for the band, or were you just thinking in the moment?
For me, no. It's like, great, let's record another one.
Okay. You know?
but for Trey, if you ask him that, I've referred to him before as being pretty prescient about where he's going musically.
Right.
If he were to have thoughts like that during the writing of it, I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay.
Because I walked in on him like when he had hair, long hair down to his ass in high school. I walked into him bouncing in a mirror with a guitar.
Trying to figure out if he could do it.
And playing as he was bouncing. And sure enough, that meant to me later that he had envisioned himself on a trampoline.
Right, he was trying to...
And he made it
can
happen.
Can I do this in front of 20,000
exactly.
people?
Exactly.
Okay, I can do it in front of myself.
Exactly. So if during the writing of Ghost he's thinking, wow, this is funky and might send us in a different direction, that wouldn't surprise me.
Right.
But it didn't occur to me.
Okay. So carry on.
Okay, so again, laying down the musical foundation, I was on drums. Trey, I think, immediately started with bass. We recorded that, and then he had this, like, his eyes lit up, and he picked up the guitar and was doing those, like, little chop it, like, geeky.
Yeah.
The geeky is so cool, the guitar, and I loved it, and I think it was just those three tracks, and he said, well, now we need vocals, and I had written the song Ghost. I'd written it. But I think I even began, like, I went up to a mic, because earlier I'd done, you know, Farmhouse and Velvet Sea and some of the other ones, and I was, like, the guy coming up with the melodies. Trey, like, said, no. He didn't want me to mess up his idea and snatch the lyrics from me, and he put me on the play record, you know, press record engineering spot, and he said, I'm going to do it in this cool staccato. He had this idea.
Okay.
And so he just started phrasing it in an amazingly unique way I never would have come up with. So I feel I never told you the story of the ghost that I once knew. You know, he like had different spacing between it that I never would have figured out. I'm more uniform. I need things sort of add up. But Trey just sort of went. And rather than let him do maybe four and then press stop and then figure out the next four, which we, that's like kind of one of our standard methods.
Okay.
To make sure that everything lines up and right. works well. I just left it on record and he just did the whole song, coming up with these spacings on the fly. And then the amazing thing, the ending of the book is, maybe he's still with me. The latch was left unhooked. He's waiting in the wind and rain. I simply haven't looked. Right when he said, I simply haven't looked, the guitar went,
and
it ended. And Trey and I looked at each other, and you can hear him on this version. He goes, wah! Like screams, like it was meant to be. It was preordained that it was exactly that length. And so we knew again that, you know, the gods were like patting us on the back.
Right,
like,
there with you.
There you go. That's how we wanted this song to be.
I feel like never told you the story of the ghost that I once knew and talked to, of whom I'd never boast. For this was my big secret, how I get ahead.
Talk about the way he was singing during that song, or during the recording. Thematically, Ghost has changed so much over 20 years. I don't know if, maybe you can allude, you can answer this, Dave. I don't know of a single Phish song that's changed as much structurally as Ghost, yet still retains this ominous, this song is going to jam, but it's going to be a dark kind of exploratory jam, then Ghost. And you go from that 97 very staccato.
Right, 97 was the very staccato. Then 98, it was more like a kind of like a drum.
He kind of gets those sirens going and they just fade into it.
Right. And then the more recent version, what, it's been like since 99 or 2000, thereabouts?
I think since they came back in 2.0.
Right,
it's got okay. that very rock intro to it. And but it still retains that, like, that structure where, like, when they sing these parts, it breaks down. And then it jams, but it's interesting to me. I mean, have you heard them write a song that changes like this one has?
Good point. No, I can't come up with one off the top of my head.
It kind of changed. The versions of Free from 1995 are very different than the ones from after Billy Breeze's recorded.
That's true. There's the middle jam. 95
had the big shoegaze style middle jam, and then he decided to add the guitar solo and then go for kind of with the funky guitar solo, then close it out.
Okay.
So that one kind of changed on the fly.
What was the song recently that, I guess, maybe it was Mike's, where someone reminded Trey about a second jam?
Oh, right. Yes.
Oh, Mike's song.
That was Andrew Hitz. Right, yeah. So Andrew Hitz was, yes, that came back in 2015 in Nashville.
I remember I was there when they came back with it, and I didn't realize what was going on. Like, really? It was a big thing in the taper community that I didn't know about.
Well, right, it was on...
It's on Twitter.
He was on Twitter that day that he's big on the Phish Twitter community.
And he told the story about being backstage.
He had a chance to meet Trey.
He suggested it to Trey.
And of the thousands of fans that have met Trey and have wanted to say something specific to Trey, none of them came as prepared as Drew did. Drew queued up the 7/14/2000 Mike song, which was the last time that they went into this jam. Because he asked Trey, as the story goes, do you remember this? And Trey, you know, said no. And as an artist, you know, it doesn't really surprise you that he's not thinking about what they did on a specific date in 2000. And Drew said, okay, well, listen to this. And he listened to it and got the chords right in his head. And then you can see on the webcast Trey talking to everyone, and they start Mike's song, and the crowd goes crazy, because now the crowd, plus everyone at home on Twitter...
Who knew about it.
Who knows about
this. Is queued up for maybe doing it.
Everyone's waiting. Yeah, is it going to happen? And then it happened, and it's a great jam, and I was really lucky. Well, that was August.
I got one in Alpine Valley.
Yeah, 2015. One of my favorite shows I've ever seen. They played a second jam in the Mike song.
Right, because it used to be the Mike's jam. The second jam would F major. Sometimes they go into simple, which is an F major, or the second jam. And then they just stopped. And usually when they play it now, they don't do the second jam very often. But it was... Yeah, that was certainly a thing.
So that's another one.
So, at this point, we just, this is the end of part two of our interview with Tom Marshall. If you're just getting this and you haven't listened to part one yet, it should be available now on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get to be on the pond, so we can have it there. And some of the themes that we ended up exploring in both part one and part two, just to recap, were how Trey and Tom became connected through music. The music that Tom listened to during Phish's hiatus, and On Musical Accidents and All My Friends, and I guess it also would say 70s and 80s progressive rock.
Yeah, definitely.
So just a quick reminder where you guys can find us online and whatnot. We are on Twitter at _BeyondThePond. We have a Medium page where we post a quick little blurb about each episode, medium.com/beyondthepond, and our ever-growing Spotify playlist, which is going to grow massively after this episode, Beyond the Pond Podcast Songs. Podcast, is it podcast playlist?
I think the playlist is actually called Beyond the Pond Podcast Songs.
Beyond the Pond Podcast Songs. So we'll link to that when we put this episode up so you guys can hear that. That is ever-growing. We're well over about 120 songs there. You press shuffle on it, you go from shoegaze to bluegrass to prog rock, maybe a Phish jam here and there that's on Spotify. A little bit of everything for you, plus the war on drugs.
Drink!
In terms of our publishing structure, you guys know that you can find us every other Tuesday Tuesdays have absolutely no feel, so why not go beyond the pond? We have done a little bit of a special publishing here with this episode, but we'll be back in two Tuesdays with our upcoming episode that I think you guys are going to like quite a bit. But before we go, Tom, really want to thank you for your time and for all the thoughts here on your own kind of creative background, your relationship with Trey. This has been really cool for us.
Oh, well, thank you, Brian, and thank you, Dave, for making the trip down to Princeton, New Jersey. Absolutely. And visiting with me. And I've learned a lot, too. You guys are consummate fish listeners, the type of fish listener I love talking to.
Sweet.
Well, thank you. This has been a fantastic afternoon. I've really learned a lot. I've enjoyed this very much. So thank you once again. And on that note, I'm David Goldstein.
I am Brian Brinkman.
And goodbye, I'm Tom Marshall.
And come back in two Tuesdays. We will join together as friends and go beyond the pond.